America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. Do you like fish? Do you ever think about how they're caught? How, in fact, the stocks are doing? When you look out over the vast oceans that surround the United States, do you really wonder about the health of the fishing stock? I don't think a lot of people do. In fact, I have a friend who said he doesn't eat anything that swims, so I'm not certain how much he really cares. But for those of us who do enjoy eating fish, we really wanted to delve into the whole aspect of commercial fishing. Many times we've read in the past that, in fact, these stocks are not doing well. And then, of course, you've got those that are farm-raised, those that are in more natural settings. We know about catch rates at times we hear about various species being depleted. We're going to talk about all of that today. But I want to tell you that the trend in this area is positive. There is something really good to share, and we're going to do it on this podcast. Stay with us here on America Trends.
With us on America Trends is Nicholas Sullivan, and he's written a book called The Blue Revolution, Hunting, Harvesting, and Farming Seafood in the Information Age. Now, I've got to tell you, Nicholas, I've really grown to love seafood much more than I have in the past, but it seems as if, in reading your book, that I'm not alone.
Well, I tell you that seafood in many parts of the world, and particularly in developing countries, is the number one source of protein. And, of course, it's a lean protein compared to most meats, so it's a valuable protein. So I started writing this book because I've been doing a lot of international development work. In international development, food security is a big issue. Of course, fish pops to the top of the charts. So I started to wonder, where are the fish going to come from to feed the world? About all the dire reports about fish disappearing.
Yeah, I've got to ask you about that, because you dispel that notion. And you say that we're getting a whole lot better at making certain that our stocks are there, that they are being harvested appropriately. Lots been going on. Because when I think about it, Nicholas, I'm going to be honest, I watch some of these shows off of the Keys or, you know, off of the shores of New England, and you and I are both New Englanders, and I see kind of guys in old boats, and they're out there, they're a little bit cranky, and I can understand they have to get up very early in the morning. They're hunters. It doesn't seem like the highest tech endeavor.
Well, you know, a lot has really changed. You know, I kind of put the kind of pivot point back to about 2000, and both for hunt, wild capture fish and farm fish, because in the 1990s, you know, there was a lot of very bad news about the overfishing and the demise in particular of the Atlantic cod and even the Atlantic scallop, which is now a huge industry. But there was a pivot point in 2000. And, of course, on the farm side, that was the Norwegian salmon farming issues were leading to the perception that it was environmentally bad, that it was degrading the sea bottom, that there was escapement and sea lice and overuse of antibiotics and so forth. But I think in 2000, everything started changing, policy started changing, behavior started changing. So it's a different ball game now. Not everywhere in the world, but so I focus on New England, which I use as a proxy for most of the United States. And the United States is a proxy for, you know, I'd say about half of the world that has got very well-managed fishery. Yeah, definitely a lot has changed in the last 20 years. And the major change really in the wild side has been the institution of annual catch limits by stock. So NOAA Fisheries manages 450 different stocks in the United States alone. And of course, other countries have other stocks that they're managing. So that, and for each one of those stocks, there's an annual catch limit, and those catch limits are divided up into individual quotas for individual boats and captains. It's very well managed, and that started in about 2010. So it's been much better for the fish than the fishermen, really, because the number of stocks that were overfished in 2000, like 47 stocks that were overfished in 2000 are now rebuilt and back, you know, and fished again. But the number of boats has diminished significantly. There are fewer people.
You tell us that older boats are being retired or retrofitted. There's a new breed of fishermen using these smarter tools to be more sustainable in terms of how they're harvesting seafood. So give us a sense of the tools that they are using. There are terms that I came upon in your book, The Blue Revolution, that I really need some help in understanding. For example, even what is aquaculture? So tell us all that's going on here that is below the surface in many ways.
So I split it basically into two parts. One is the wild capture, the hunted, you know, fish, the old-fashioned fishing, and then the aquaculture, which is farm fish. And I focus on marine aquaculture, you know, ocean aquaculture. At this point, about half the fish in the world that are eaten, produced, and consumed are farmed, which, again, is a big shift from the 1990s. That really started to take off in the 1990s. The majority of the farm fish are freshwater, but I focus on the saltwater, the marine. So in terms of the technologies, the aquaculture side is actually more advanced because they're using real, you know, a lot of sensors, machine learning, artificial intelligence, automatic feeding systems, automatic monitoring systems, very high-tech endeavor, which is designed, you know, to keep fish alive for 2 to 3 years or 1 to 2 years until they are kind of market size. On the wild side, the technology is more in new gear to allow certain fish to escape from the net, the fish you're trying to avoid catching. You have larger rings or smaller nets or whatever. You have electronic monitoring on the boats so that observers from shore, the regulators, the NOAA Fisheries can see what is going on at sea. In terms of surveying stocks, because, you know, each year the stocks are surveyed to determine the annual catch limit, and a lot of that is being done with underwater cameras that are feeding signals up to the pilot house that are turned into, you know, machine learning algorithms that are giving people a sense of the type of species, the size, the density, and so forth. So it's become much more science-based, evidence-based in terms of developing policy. Because, you know, until, you know, 2000 or so, it was like, take whatever you want, pretty much. I mean, there were limits. There were days at sea regulations. You could only go out so many days per sea, depending on the target. But it was kind of what I say kind of led to the tragedy of the commons, that everyone could do what they wanted. And, of course, they did. And it led to kind of a decline in a lot of stocks.
We thought, because there was a lot of news that the oceans were in trouble, that we were depleting various stocks, things that many of us loved. And then all of a sudden, as you say, I mean, what happened here? Is it a combination of good news about government getting involved and actually making a fundamentally important difference? Is it that the technology and government regulation together really has made this a much different kind of industry? What's happening?
I think that it is the NOAA Fisheries, which regulates fishing in the United States, made policy changes. And I think a lot of it actually was driven by starting in the mid-90s or early 90s, really, when the cod counts were way down. There was a series of lawsuits that started running from environmental NGOs against the fishery councils, against NOAA Fisheries, and so forth. So there was pressure from environmentalists to, like, you know, stop the overfishing, to avoid bycatch and all these things. So the law was rewritten in the Magnuson-Stevens Act, which, you know, was a congressional act from 1976, was rewritten in 1996 and 2006. And both those rewrites focused on preserving the ecosystem, preserving the habitat, preserving the individual stocks. It led to policy changes for NOAA that really led to changes in behavior. And, of course, concomitant with that was the increase in technology, which made it easier for fishermen to target the species they want rather than just putting out nets and taking everything that, you know, landed in them. They could more easily target the abundant species and catch them without pulling up a lot of unwanted bycatch that is often just left, you know, to die.
You say that it's all part of a fourth industrial revolution that's using big data, sensors, machine learning, AI, and I find it so fascinating because we consider it a throwback industry. I think you even define it as such. New England fishing, which you focused on, I love North Atlantic New England fishing because many of us who live here, it's a big part of our lives, particularly in the summer. You say arguably was America's first industry. Explain the importance of this region, New England, for fishing and the university-rich area and its impact, because I mentioned government, technology, but the universities have gotten involved in trying to make this a much more modern process.
Oh, yeah. Well, the University of Maine, New Hampshire, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, Connecticut, they're all got a very well-developed fisheries. UMass Boston and, you know, the School for Marine Science in New Bedford. Yeah, so they're very involved. The importance, like Gloucester, it was, you know, the oldest fishery in the U.S., started in the 1600s, and it's in their city charter that they were going to live off the cod. There's a carving of a sacred cod and hangs in the Massachusetts State House. Hmm. So, you know, a lot of New England was really built on the cod. I mean, so when I say arguably the first industry, I'm sure, you know, kind of timbering and, was up there, but really, in terms of the value, it was the fish, which has really built the New England economy in the 16, 1700s.
Do we subsidize fishing like we do farming? I know you talk about subsidies in the book, but help me understand where we are today in relation to that.
Well, you know, one of the things that first attracted me to fishing was in the 70s when I was in college writing about this, the fact that there weren't really any subsidies compared to, say, beef or agricultural farmers who were getting, you know, milk farmers and beef farmers were getting government subsidies. Fishermen weren't. But after the incursion of, you know, Russian and foreign factory ships in the 70s that were kind of raiding our shores before the 200-mile limit, the U.S. government did start offering subsidies in the 80s, which led to a kind of overbuilding of fishing boats, putting too many boats on the water without enough regulation, which was part of the problem, I think, in terms of the overfishing, because it was easier to get and buy a boat, and there were very few restrictions. So that led to the 90s, which, you know, was a kind of beginning or downward spiral. You know, the other story that I start out with, and it's also the kind of the pivot point in 2000, is in the mid-90s, the Atlantic scallop industry was kind of at a standstill. All the beds were closed pretty much, partly because the scallopers were catching a lot of yellowtail flounder, which is also another kind of iconic species. So the scallop beds were shut down. And then in the late 90s, there was a real collaboration between fishermen, scientists, and regulators to study with underwater cameras the incidence of scallop growth in beds, very kind of discrete quadrants on the ocean floor. And they found that there were areas where there were a lot of scallops. So they opened the beds that were where there was an abundant number of scallops and closed the other ones. And then they closed down those beds that were fished and moved on to the others. And it became a very scientific, you know, kind of a, like rotating crops and fields. It was a kind of behavioral switch, the idea that you can't just go anywhere anytime, but you've got to really think and plan and rotate. And so that's part of the behavioral shift, I think, that has kind of taken hold. And, of course, the other thing now is there are more groundfish in the North Atlantic than there were 20, 25 years ago, which is not what people think. The perception is that there's no fish left. You know, the number of cod is down, the number of flounder is way down. But there's a lot of haddock, there's a lot of redfish, there's a lot of pollock, there's a lot of dogfish, there's hake, there's fluke, there's halibut, there's you know, there's a lot of fish out there. Another movement, which is kind of, a food-related or fishy-related movement to get people to try out, now called underutilized or unloved species. Because most, Americans like, farmed shrimp and salmon from around the world, or tuna. But there, so there's now a big move to try to get people to try and use more abundant species.
You've got to help us, Nicholas, because, by the way, the book we're talking about is The Blue Revolution, Hunting, Harvesting, and Farming Seafood in the Information Age. It's really important because more than 3 billion people now get 20% of their protein from fish. Fish consumption between 1990 and 2018 globally rose by 122%. So obviously, we are enjoying our fish. But the question is, you say in the book that we export a lot of fish, and then often it's processed elsewhere and comes back to the United States. Explain what's happening in this process, because I know my wife likes to read the labels. Where did this particular product come from, particularly things we're going to put in our bodies? Help us understand what's happening here.
If she were to read some of the labels, it would say product of the USA, but it doesn't necessarily mean it was processed in the USA. You know, you talked about the technology. There are places in the world, such as Asia and Iceland and Norway, that have far superior processing plants, very high tech, very clean, very efficient. A lot of squid is exported to China to be processed and then reshipped back to the U.S. Alaskan pollock, or Pacific pollock, which is like often the number one catch in the world, is often processed overseas and then reshipped to the U.S. I mean, those are the two that come to mind, but it's because of the more efficient processing capabilities in some parts of the world. So there's now New Bedford in particular, which is the number one port by value, fishing port in the U.S., has introduced in the last 10 years a lot of new, very high-tech, state-of-the-art processing. New Bedford Harbor is now crammed with 350 boats. They're coming in from Maine to from Florida to offload, and part of it is because there's the infrastructure there that to handle volumes of fish. So hopefully that is going to continue to change, because now, some of the people say that, people in Iceland can deliver cod to Boston that is fresher and better cut at a lower price than you can from New England ports to Boston.
You talk about the demise of the Atlantic cod, and it's because of these quicker warming trends, and that brought the scientists, regulators, and fishermen together using high tech, refining their view of the whole marine ecosystem. Describe what was happening there, and was there some reluctance? Because when I think of some of these fishermen, I think of a weathered, kind of a beaten person who's out there doing really wonderful work, and they know their stuff, but I never see them as being trendsetters in wanting to adapt to new practices. And yet, the demise of the Atlantic cod really helped to move this process along?
Well, again, like I said, it led to a lot of lawsuits. It also led somewhat after the fact to a realization that the warming of the Gulf of Maine, which is warming faster than ocean water anywhere else in the world, was probably in large part or small part, no one knows how important it was, to the demise of the cod, because the cod like colder waters. So overfishing was definitely part of it, but they may also have gone into deeper, colder waters further north, like the stocks in the Barents Sea up around Iceland and Norway. Atlantic cod are strong. They've always been better managed. Earlier on they were better managed, but the water is probably better. So it wasn't until 2015 that there was a paper from the Gulf of Maine Research Institute saying that the warming waters may have had serious impact on the spawning of the cod. And I think that's becoming a more prevalent theory in fisheries management. And the other thing that the warming water is doing is it's changing the location of the fish. The fish are moving north, so that species that were abundant in the mid-Atlantic are now moving up into New England. species that were abundant in New England, like northern shrimp, have basically gone. The lobster are moving north. So there's a whole resetting of the table, as it were, in the ecosystem. And the other thing is that the regulators, NOAA Fisheries, has been doing is, you know, initially the Magnuson-Stevens Act was talking about the max, you can fish any stock to the maximum sustainable yield based on the best science. But that was one fish. And now they realize you can't just talk about one stock without looking at the whole ecosystem. And of course, the warming has also played into that. So now there's a much more holistic approach to, and it's not coming from the fishermen. It's coming from the regulators, really.
Now, let me ask you, this whole notion of wild hunting of fish morphing into sustainable harvesting. I know even in a community here in Connecticut that is not on the shore, there's an on-land aquaculture program. But explain the difference, because I remember I was at the Monterey Aquarium some years ago, and I saw some marking on the wall when they described what was going on. And there was, I think at that time, there was a preference for the wild fish versus those that have been harvested in farms. But tell us the difference and what's happening one to the next.
That is a very interesting question, and I'll start answering it by saying that I heard the head of aquaculture for the Nature Conservancy, Robert Jones, give a talk a few weeks ago. He said, you know, when he was younger, not that long ago, 10 or 15, 20 years ago, the saying was that friends don't let friends eat farmed fish. And you probably got something of like that from the Monterey Bay Aquarium. And a lot of that dates to the, as I was saying, to the perception from the 1990s that it was environmentally really bad. Antibiotics were being used. It was like weakening the whole genetic strain. There was a fear of interbreeding between farmed and wild. And so to your point about the latest movement in farmed fish is land-based aquaculture, which is farming fish in tanks on land. And you mentioned one in Connecticut. You're probably talking about Ideal Fish in Waterbury, Connecticut?
Yes. Yes. I'm right outside of Waterbury. Yeah.
Right. Branzino. I've been there. That's a kind of state-of-the-art plant. And one of the themes I have in this book is that fishing is moving into the post-industrial age. And one of the things I love about it is so that that farm and the salmon farms in Maine that are going to old paper mills are taking the old industrial, you know, plants and turning them into these modern high-tech fish farms. But anyway, they solve a lot of the problems, you know, of, you know, there's no environmental impact on the oceans. There's no chance of escapement there. And all you need is a source of fresh water which can be recirculated and cleansed. So there are fish farms in Wisconsin and Indiana that are not, you know, close to the ocean at all. I mean, they're farming salmon in Wisconsin and Indiana. And that's a saline, or, you know, requires salt water. Yeah, it's a huge breakthrough. It's much less controversial. It's much cleaner, much more environmentally sound. The issue there is the economics. Can you scale these fish farms, these land-based farms, and be profitable, because they're very expensive to run in terms of electricity. There's a lot of water. There's a lot of high-tech systems. You know, there's a lot of chance for breakdowns. There have been breakdowns. And if they do, then you lose a lot of fish. It's evolved a lot in the last 10 or 20 years.
What is the global fishing watch that you talk about in the book?
Yeah, well, this is a great example of the fourth industrial revolution. This is a group started by Skywatch and Google and Oceana, I believe. SkyTruth, Google, and Oceana, three nonprofits designed to study ship traffic on the oceans. And they can show you on an internet map almost in real time the ship traffic on all the world's oceans. And they have been able to determine by machine learning algorithms which boats are fishing, which boats are, you know, freighters, which boats are cruise ships, and so just by the behavior of the ships. One of the big issues, much bigger issue than I ever thought it was in fishing is, you know, the illegal, unreported fishing, IUU fishing, which is kind of, you know, pirates or even sovereign states that are illegally fishing, it's like 30% of the world catch. And it's very harmful to, you know, the resources of the ocean, and particularly because they're targeting valuable species, tuna, shark, Chilean sea bass, and so forth. But this Global Fishing Watch, which can track some of this stuff and can see when boats are gathering around a larger ship, which usually means, you know, that's transshipping from a smaller boat to a larger factory boat, usually means illegal fishing. And they've been using that to apprehend and indict and convict, you know, the captains and often the white-collar cartels that are behind them.
You talk about the clear ecological and environmental benefits of fish versus meat production. And I know there are people who are grading their intake and they're saying, well, I don't want to go totally without protein from some, you know, being. And so they're going to fish. You know, some start marginally and they get away from actual red meat, and then they go to chicken, ultimately perhaps to fish. Explain how much different the process is for farming, if you will, the fish versus meat production. And do you see that as a clear trend across the country, at least, if not the world?
Definitely see it as a clear trend. The key thing is that physiologically, fish require much less food per volume. So the food conversion for fish is basically 1-to-1, sometimes less than 1-to-1, you know, pound of feed for a pound of fish. Whereas in cattle and pigs and chickens, it's 7-to-1, 5-to-1, 3-to-1. So much more feed is required. And of course, in terms of all the land-based, you know, meat farming, then there's also the degradation of the land, whereas particularly in these recirculating land-based tanks where they're just reusing the water over and over again, there's very little negative impact on the environment. So that's really where I was going. But the physiology of fish compared to meat animals on land is better suited to being raised. The land-based farming is, and even the offshore farming now, because it's done further offshore, cleansed naturally by stronger currents, is much less environmentally detrimental than most land-based farming.
Animals. Deep water, when we think about deep water, there was something in the book about how far offshore, and I'm just wondering about what's happening out there competition-wise, and do we want to keep fishing somewhat closer to land, or what is it about the deep water that we are trying to protect or at least not degradate in the way that perhaps we've done closer to shore?
If you think about aquaculture, so there are three main types. There's the land-based we've been talking about. There's the shellfish and kelp and so forth, which are kind of near shore. You know, they're kind of near shore estuaries, not far offshore. They're very restorative and very helpful. They clean the water. They absorb CO2. I mean, the kelp does. They require no food. They live off plankton and nutrients in the water. So that is kind of the number one ecological winner, really clearly, shellfish and kelp. But in terms of the offshore, so offshore in this case means 3 miles out is state waters. 3 miles to 200 miles is federal waters. So offshore is more than 3 miles offshore, you know, technically. And the virtue of going offshore is you get, you know, stronger currents and deeper water. So you don't have that kind of soiling of the sea bottom that you have in nearer shore and shallower waters. In the U.S., aquaculture is the fastest growing form of food production in the world. Hmm. And the U.S. has 1% of that market. It ranks 17th in the world behind even countries like North Korea and Myanmar. It's really a laggard in aquaculture, and we have a $17 billion trade deficit now. If we don't increase our aquaculture, that's going to increase. So that's why there's a lot of push to do offshore farming, because it's being done in other parts of the world. But very few farms have been permitted in the U.S. because it's controversial. You know, there's a lot of environmental groups don't like it. There's a lot of spatial planning for the ocean and navigational stuff. And, you know, there's a lot of usage of the ocean and they don't want farms. So it's a tough issue. And of course, in New England, there's the right whale issue. People do not want ropes in the water, and they're even trying to get lobster men to go ropeless and have their tanks kind of digitally controlled by iPhones. As you can imagine, lobster men are not too excited about.
Now, you say that the ongoing major problems afflicting global fisheries, number one, illegal, unreported, unregulated fishing. You talked about that earlier, and you can talk about where the worst abuses are. Degradation of the mangrove and the seafloor. Drift nets that were outlawed by the UN in 1992, and you talked about we being much more protective of these gill nets or whatever we want to call them, and too much waste. And we know that plastics are really in abundance in the ocean. So tell us what we've really got to concentrate on and whether the regulators are focused on one or more of these areas with more intensity.
The big problem is that a lot of the stuff we're just talking about there, the long lines, the drift nets, the plastic pollution, the illegal fishing, a lot of it is done on the so-called high seas, which is beyond the 200-mile territorial limit of any country. So no one really has jurisdiction over the high seas. There are various treaties, you know, for tuna, which are migratory, and they go in and out of the high seas, countries' territories, but it's very hard to regulate policy-wise what goes on in the high seas, and it's even harder to enforce it, even if there were regulations, because it's such a massive. The ocean is 70% of the planet, and 60% of it is the high seas, so that's the Wild West still. That's no man's land, the Wild West, and that's where this Global Fishing Watch and other things, why they're so important, because that's the first real window into what is happening on the high seas, you know, in real time. So that is a real start in, you know, beginning to understand it and regulate it and enforce it, because a lot of the bad stuff is happening in a very small parts of the world, and you can isolate those, and, you know, there are now kind of more regional consortiums, the country alliances. There's one, you know, the west coast of Africa's got one, the east coast of South America, Pacific Islanders have them. So they're now, and these are where some of the worst, you know, abuses are going on. So I try to be hopeful about this. You know, part of what I realized when I started doing this, I started out trying to look at, you know, where's the food going to come from, quickly realized that the perception of fishing, both wild capture and farming, was very negative. So part of what I was am trying to do is write a different narrative, because I think there is a different narrative. And I suppose I may be too optimistic in places, but, I mean, what are you going to do? You got to hope for the best.
Well, no, you do that in the book. Yeah, you talk about the 21st century transformation of the country's original industry from unsustainable to sustainable, from sustainable to restorative, from industrial to post-industrial. I think that's all going in the right direction.
Exactly. I think so. And, you know, there are still a few parts of the world where it's not happening. I mean, Asia, South Asia are kind of trouble spots. You know, more than half the world, I think, is on the same page, and there's more and more pressure on the other parts of the world, because even the South China Sea, which has got, you know, seven or eight countries claim jurisdiction to different parts of that, the fish are disappearing. They've got, you know, just to preserve their own livelihood and food supply, they've got to change, you know, their approach. And I think that is beginning to happen. China's a problem. They're trying to say that the entire South China Sea is ours, but it's not. But, you know, it's a geopolitical issue for sure.
Well, we've got a few more of those, too. Blue Revolution, hunting, harvesting, and farming seafood in the information age. Nicholas Sullivan, our guest, a fascinating topic. And again, when we look over the beautiful blue waters, if you live near the coast, it's something that you must imagine that there's a lot of activity going on out there, but most of us don't understand really what's involved. I hope after listening to Nicholas, you have a better idea. I know clearly I do. And I thank you so much for being with us today on America Trends.
Well, I thank you so much. It was a treat to talk to you, and I thank you for the opportunity. And I should just add to one thing to what you said about people looking out on the beautiful blue ocean. that in many parts of the country there may be a land-based farm coming to you, even if you live in a landlocked state.
Yeah, like I do in a post-industrial era, an old industrial factory being retrofitted in the old brass capital of the world, the Waterbury,
right.
Connecticut. So, Nicholas, thank you again.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.